I'm Mary Carlson. I've met a number of you, but not everybody yet. I teach social work at St. Olaf, one of the 27 ELCA colleges in Northfield, Minnesota. This is a session on end-of-life decision-making. It's the third in my series on family challenges, faith questions. As I've introduced each of them, I've said I could pick any number of family challenges. This happens to be five that I felt like teaching on this year. You could name many others, probably many of which some of you are dealing with as we speak. Today's topic, I think, is one that increasingly people, when I teach, acknowledge that they've had experience with in their families or friends or congregations. And so I think it's always useful to reintroduce something that is all too real for many people and will be at some point, if it hasn't been already, for probably everyone in this room. I'm a teacher of 18 to 22-year-olds normally, so it's a treat to talk with adults. I'm a practitioner, older adults, I should say. I'm a social work practitioner. I fill in on occasion at our Northfield Hospital, even though I teach full-time, so that I can keep a finger in the real world. As I do that, I do these advanced directive conversations with families a fair amount. Whether it's from the beginning, we've never thought about this, we don't know what to do, to mom has decided and here it is, and where do we put it at the hospital? We'll put in a little plug for next week. If some of you are here through next week, Dan and I are doing a series on bioethics, and we'll certainly touch on some of those questions here today. Let me ask here, how many of you are healthcare professionals, broadly defined, including ministers who go to hospitals when people are sick? Nurses or social workers, doctors? Okay. How many of you have had some personal experience where an advanced directive of some type would have been useful? Okay. Has anybody had an experience where advanced directives were not useful? Complicated a situation too much. That, we'll get there. For those of you who don't know yet, we'll get to an advanced directive. Okay, they're not perfect instruments, but we'll talk about it. Okay, what I want to do today is discuss some of the reasons to do advanced care planning, some of the types of medical treatment that we suggest everybody consider. There are a few primary issues that everybody should think about ahead of time, and describe some of the different legal documents to consider when doing end-of-life planning. And I have some samples that I'll pass out towards the end here. because much of what I talk about is heavy and can be kind of sad, and I said last evening when I talk about AIDS, I visibly see people's bodies kind of sagging. Like, oh, this is so enormous. I'm going to ask Jim sometime what he does about overpopulation. I can't imagine that's particularly upbeat, but I think it's wise to have humor wherever we can. And I have a couple overheads that will help us a little bit. This gentleman is saying, what? And play God? And here the patient says, please let me die. What? And play God? And one of my favorites. I've already made arrangements to be flushed down the toilet. Isn't that great?
Well, what will the kids say?
What will the kids say? All right. I want to particularly thank the Minnesota Extension Service at the U of M and Marlene Stumm, who is a family social science faculty person who has put together a marvelous layperson's packet on advanced care planning, and I'm using sections of that. She was also on the committee that wrote the legislation in Minnesota that sets out advanced directives, which I'll mention shortly. Newsweek, June 1999. See if you recognize the person being talked about here. The hospital seemed deserted. As I signed in, the guard, seeing that I was another U-doll, raved about how much everyone in Washington had admired and loved Lanky Moe when he was in his prime. But for the last 6 years, he had been confined to a hospital bed in a near vegetative state due to the Parkinson's, which had been complicated by a fall and a resulting head injury. I wasn't ready for the shock, but suddenly I was in Moe's hospital room. It disturbed me that not only did Moe have a feeding tube entering just under his ribs, but he also had a tracheotomy, a hole in his windpipe, to suck out his lungs fluids. Is all this overtreatment necessary, I wondered to myself. But Moe hadn't created a healthcare advanced directive. oral and written instructions that would have let his doctor and family know his wishes in the event that he slipped into a coma or vegetative state. Most important, while he was still alert and capable, he could have used the health care power of attorney to appoint someone he trusted to make decisions about his medical care when he was no longer able to. This is titled When Someone is Alive But Not Living, written by Mo Udall's cousin, telling people to please think about doing this ahead of time because of the difficulty they had in letting Mo die in the situation he was in with advanced Parkinson's and a head injury. If someone wants to read the rest, you certainly can. Some of you heard last night a little about my mother. She's the other case study I've often used because she was 61 years old and in end-stage Alzheimer's and in a nursing home, and for 2 years had not recognized any of her children. There were five of us. My mother was widowed. She was unable to feed herself, unable to take food, actually. And she was diagnosed with pneumonia. And we had a decision to make, the five of us children, whether we should treat her pneumonia, which could be cured, and she could return to her state of not knowing any of us, not knowing where she was, laying in a bed, essentially in a fetal position, hardly able to walk, or let the pneumonia end her life by not treating it. Five of us children, who do you suppose is responsible for making that decision for Mom? Five of us children. Five of us children. If one of us had said, I want Mom's pneumonia treated, what would that doctor have done? Treated my mother's pneumonia. Even if four of us, even the oldest daughter, vociferous as I can be, said, don't do it, that doctor would have done it. The reason is that 4 or 5 years prior to that, after Mom had been diagnosed, she was an RN. I was working in a nursing home in Seattle. I said, Mom, what are you going to want us to do for you at the end when you can't decide? And she said, and I quote, God and my children will do what's right. She would not talk about it any more than that. Trust my children to do what's right. God and my children will decide. We were fortunate that all five of us agreed that we would not treat my mother's pneumonia. And we watched her die for almost a week. She was 61. She was very strong. She wasn't 91. Maybe 91-year-olds, many are very strong too. Fortunately, we have not regretted the decision. Do we all say it was easy and we can live easily with it? No, I wouldn't say that. But we're all glad we did it and certainly don't regret it. Okay, so why is it important to do some end-of-life planning ahead of time? Oh, and why is it good to learn how to do these? There we go. I'm going to go over some basic information first and then some common terms that are used across the country because people get a little confused between terms. Some types of treatment to particularly consider. How to go about choosing an agent, which we'll talk about, how to communicate your decisions, and then I hope I'll talk fast enough so we'll have some time for conversation again. Why is it important to plan for end of life? 80 to 90% of us will die in a healthcare facility. 80 to 90% of us. Daniel Petrock says, a good death does honor to an entire life. It's part of our whole life. It's also a national law in 1992, the Patient Self-Determination Act, that said every healthcare facility in this country is required to let patients in that facility, and that means doctor's office, hospital, hospice, long-term care, home care programs. They're all required to let people know that you have the right to do advanced care planning and a right to do an advanced care directive. Now, does that mean every time you go to a doctor when you have a cyst or you need your eyes checked, they're going to say, by the way, you have the right to do this? No, they're supposed to, but they don't, and I understand why. But they all have information about it, so any one of you can ask any one of your healthcare providers for information about advanced directives in your state. That PSDA of 1992 said patients have the right to control their medical care by consenting to or refusing medical treatment. We can consent or refuse. We have the right to understand our own health problems, our potential options for care, and what the effect would be of accepting or rejecting certain treatments, and what those treatments might have as effect on our quality of life. It's also important to think about advanced care planning because we have autonomy in this country. In fact, when we talk in medical ethics about the principles approach to health care, there are four essentially equal principles, but autonomy trumps them in our country. I have the right to decide what I want to do. Beneficence or do no harm is in there, not maleficence, justice, but autonomy has trumped thus far, though many people are doing work to look at maybe how justice needs to be brought up to the fore here. But if it's important to you to have some control, it's important for you to know that your rights to some autonomy and control do not end when you are incapable of making decisions. You still have those rights. Now, you can't say what you want at that time, but you still have rights. The way to carry those out are to have an advanced care directive. You can have input now about who will decide for you and what you'd like to say to guide them in their decisions for you. Now, if somebody in the room here is somebody who says, I trust whomever, my spouse, my parents, my partner, my kids, or, well, what will be, or God is in charge, then you might want to go out and do some hiking at the moment, or you might want to stay so I can change your mind about that. To do this kind of advanced care planning and to think ahead is the greatest gift you can give the loved ones who will need to decide for you when you can't decide. I believe that firmly. It's a tremendous gift you can give. I finished some research on my last sabbatical that resulted in a little published guide here that I'll give to any of you who do these decisions with families, professionals. I don't have very many to give out, but doctors, clergy, social workers, nurses, I'll give those out. And we found a number of things. We interviewed people around Minnesota about these discussions about end of life that they had with their doctors, their nurses, or their social workers. And we found a number of interesting things. People want to talk about this. Only 6% of the people in our study didn't want to talk about it. Most people want to. People often have preset opinions about this. How many of you have thought about these issues before for you? Pretty hard not to. It's in front of our face much of the time in the media and in our personal experience. People in generally are very pleased to have a conversation about this, whether with family or with healthcare professionals. It didn't seem to matter in our study whether you knew a physician one day or 50 years. To have this discussion, all that mattered was that that physician or nurse or social worker was respectful and compassionate when talking about it. So some doctors say, oh, I can't discuss it with somebody in the ER or when they enter the nursing home, I just met these people. People said, it doesn't matter. As long as that person respects me and has compassion, I'll talk about it with anybody. Another thing that was interesting is to discuss this in some good detail doesn't take very long because most people have thought about it. Most people in this room have pretty clear ideas what they want. Most people do. So what are some of the common terms we use? Let me just talk about those for a couple minutes. Minnesota's law now in our state is putting into the common lexicon the term advanced directive. No, I'm changing my mind, sorry. In Minnesota, it's healthcare directive. They've just changed it. It's often called advanced directive. In Minnesota, it's called a healthcare directive. Other states call it other things. The common term is living will. I don't like that. Why don't I like that?
Because you're dying?
Well, that's a thought. That's not what bugs me. What bugs me is this word. Because a will is something else. A will is something that says, when I'm dead, when I am gone, here's what I want you to do with my stuff, my property, my belongings. A will is for death. A living will is for life, and so that can be useful. But people think, well, I did a living will because I already said that my daughter is the executor. Two different documents, completely different documents. Living will is for living. So I think healthcare directive, advanced directive is more useful. Will is for when you're dead, okay? That's an important distinction. Now, the person that we, boy, I can't spell the name, perhaps he is with a Y. The person that we designate to make decisions for us in the event that we are incapable of making decisions, some states call it the healthcare agent, some call it the proxy. We'll probably go back and forth. We're getting used to agent in Minnesota. These are legal terms, and I'll come back to that. A power of attorney is another common document. It's more than one kind, however. There is a medical power of attorney, sometimes called a healthcare power of attorney, and then there are financial powers of attorney. So again, I get patients who say to me, yeah, I wrote out a power of attorney. My daughter can write checks, transfer assets, change my savings account. That is financial power of attorney. That has nothing to do with making medical decisions when someone's facing surgery or nursing home placement or pulling of turning off the respirator or pulling a feeding tube. We walk in with a power of attorney and all it does is a bunch of boxes that say yes for the checking, yes for the savings, yes for the trust account. It's useless. So there's a set of financial stuff, the will and the power of attorney, financial. And then there's a set of medical stuff. Questions about that? Those are important things to keep straight. They're all important to do, but today we're focusing on the medical stuff.
Mary, in the living will, though, as I understand it, they can designate each of those.
It depends on the state.
My mom's.
Okay, where's your mom live?
California.
Okay. Minnesota's statute just changed this year to combine, to make it more confusing, the former living will with the former durable power of attorney for health care. So now I have examples of the Minnesota one. You can do both on one form. In some states, they're still separate. I think I'll just say right in here, the most important thing you could do, if you don't want to think about respirators and pain control, anything else, the most important thing you could do is name a proxy for healthcare decisions. Name a proxy. You can do that by getting a form for a durable power of attorney for healthcare or a medical power of attorney, because then you don't have to think about it anymore. That person does. Now, we'll get to that in just a minute. But that, if you want to just do that, you've done a lot, okay? Any more questions about the documents themselves?
Could you go into a little bit of the difference between the advance directive and your power of attorney for health care?
Yes.
Or is that coming
Yeah, no, let me do it right here. The power of attorney for health care is a very short document. It just says, I, so-and-so, the undersigned, in the event that I am unable to make decisions for myself, appoint so-and-so to be my proxy in medical decisions,
okay,
and maybe another paragraph. It has to generally be notarized by a notary, or, in Minnesota, it can be witnessed by two people who know you and know you're writing it when you're of clear mind and not under duress, and those two witnesses have to be people who cannot stand to benefit by your death. In other words, be in your will over here. And in Minnesota, they do allow now one of the witnesses to be a healthcare provider, say a nurse's aide who's cared for this person for a year or two and knows them well. They can be one of the witnesses. So that's a very short document in most states.
Are they sometimes combined?
With the living will then?
Or with a directive along with the power of attorney?
Well, see, in Minnesota now they are. The health care directive includes, I don't know about Wisconsin.
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, I think it is too, because I know what I've got. It kind of sounds like it's got both of those elements in it.
But the proxy, it doesn't automatically kick in when you're laying on a bed not being able to. It has to be in Wisconsin. I think two physicians have to certify that you are not capable of making your own decision, and now your proxy kicks in.
Right.
Two physicians have to serve.
I think something like that.
Yeah. Well, that gets a little hairy because who's competent is a question. The medical and ethics folks use the term decisional capacity. Can you make a decision in this situation about this? And there are three elements to decisional capacity. One, you understand the information you're being told, the risks and benefits of something. Two, you can make a decision in your own mind. And three, you can communicate that decision. So, some people with severe strokes, who may well be understanding it, but we can't tell because they can't tell us, would be deemed incapable of making this decision. Does that mean they're incompetent? That's a more legalistic term. That means you are, you know, sort of unable to function without total care, and that often means guardianship and some other things. So, decisional capacity about health care is what comes into play. Different states are going to be a little different. Minnesota's was just combined because our previous living will, different form from the durable power of attorney for medical care, the living will only could go into play when two doctors certified that someone had 6 months or left to live. So it didn't cover all the people in persistent vegetative state lying on respirators, unable, the Karen Quinlan kind of case, Nancy Kruzan kind of case, they live a long time on machines, didn't cover them. So finally, we have combined them. So that's a good question. So it's two elements to always look for, maybe in one form, maybe two forms in your state. An advance directive or a healthcare directive or a living will, and then the durable power of attorney. And I say durable, that needs to be in there, because that means it goes through when you're incapacitated for making decisions. Okay.
Harry, there's, considering there are people from different states and all, going to the Five Wishes document might be a good place for a lot of people to start.
And I got information about that here just out of the paper as I left, so please take a look at that. Concern for dying in New York City. I've got some good references here at the end, too, to find out about your own state. The offices on aging in every state have this info, but your doctor also should. Your doctor also should. But some states do have very complicated forms. Our Minnesota form is fairly complicated, as you'll see it. But the statute says, as long as your form looks substantially like this form in the statute, it's legal in Minnesota. Now, do you think anyone in Minnesota lives half the time in Florida or Arizona or other places? Yeah. Do you think they need two different advance directives? Yes. Depends on where it happens. There is not a national protection here. And if people spend half their time at a lake cabin in another state, you need to check out that state too, if you really want to be good at this. So if you get, you know, injured in a car accident and you're in a persistent vegetative state there, you need to know that states
are
different.
What about like when you're on vacation and stuff?
Well, I think it depends.
Get weird?
It can get weird, except they probably would say, look, she's a Minnesota or a Wisconsin resident, happens to be driving through, so they would hold yours, I think. And it does often come down to who's going to argue about it. If you happen to get a physician in the state where you're injured, who says, I don't care where she's from, she's here now, you're in for a little fight. It's kind of a mess. Okay, well, we can come back to some of those questions. So what are some of the things you need to think about for the living will or advance directive, which is generally a more complicated document? It doesn't have to be. But ours has six pages, I think, where you can write your wishes related to a number of different things. And you'll see that in just a little bit. One thing I would say first as a caveat, people get all nervous because you cannot foresee what's going to happen to you. So you cannot use an advance directive to say, if it's this, I want this. If it's this, I want this. But it might be this, and then I want this, and it could be this. And what if it's something we don't even know about yet? Okay? So it's not a specific instructions about disease or injury per se. But there are a few areas that are important to think through ahead of time that are fairly common and the most problematic for families when they're making decisions. What are those? The first one is the ventilator or the respirator. That is the machine that breathes for you. When you cannot breathe, you're on a machine to breathe for you. Are those ever used for short term?
Sure.
People can be on ventilators for 2 days and get off them. People with heart attacks can be on vents for a couple days and get off. People can be on them for weeks and get off them. My 14-year-old niece, very sad story, was on a ventilator this year for 4 months. She's completely off now. So one thing to think about with a machine breathing for you is what you believe about that, and I'll come to that also in a minute, and whether you would want it used for short term or forever. And you can say forever. I mean, there are situations where physicians can say this person will not survive off the respirator, period. As much as we can say about anybody not surviving. Okay, so ventilator or respirator is the first one. The second one is nutritional support and hydration. What we're talking about here is a medical treatment. This is agreed upon across the country. Ethicists, theologians, physicians have said artificial feeding and nutrition is a medical, and hydration is a medical treatment. That is a nasogastric tube up your nose and down into your stomach, a J-tube or a G-tube that goes right into your stomach through your skin, or an IV nutrition or hydration in through the skin. Those are determined to be medical treatments. What that means is you may say no. You may also say stop. Ethicists and theologians across the country agree that that is okay, to say no to artificial nutrition and hydration. very complex, but we're there nationally pretty much. And we can come back to that. The third thing is cardiopulmonary resuscitation. Many of you have been trained in CPR in the 60s. We tried to train the whole world. Now we all think that CPR is a great thing for everybody to know. Now, what do you think the chance is? One of us in this room who's fairly healthy, say 40 to 60 years old, no underlying terminal, something or other, keels over right here, and we start CPR. We really skilled people who know what we're doing, and we get them out to Chelan. What's the chance they're going to survive to discharge from Chelan Hospital? Any idea?
2%.
How many? Oh, you're two negative, Tom. 90? Oh, you're two positive. This is good. The best chance anybody has, the best chance, about 40%. 38 to 40%. Tons of studies have been done. Tons. Okay? On ER and similar kinds of shows, and that's the only show I watch, and I love that show. What do you think the rate of success is for their CPR in the ER with people leaving the hospital? Yeah, 102. Yeah, they are heroes. My point exactly. Most TV shows show CPR in a variety of situations as about 75% successful. So the average layperson thinks, well, I have a 75 to 100% 102% chance of surviving CPR. The chance is really lots lower. And if you are 75, 85 years old, living in a long-term care center, just by your age, your chance is closer to 5 to 7%. Now, when people hear that, it changes their thinking a little bit. Not everybody, but some people. So CPR is an important thing to know. If I have a heart attack or a respiratory arrest, do I want someone to start doing pounding on my chest? Do I want them to give me heart-stimulating drugs? Do I want them to do electroshock to get my heart going? Think about that. That's the third big thing. And the fourth one is I sort of put under medications, and it's really two big things. The first is antibiotics for the situation like my mother. Pneumonia, to the turn of the century, was called the old man's friend. Not a bad way to die. These days, it's really not bad because we can give morphine, we can give ice chips, we can give oxygen. That's not treatment. That is palliative care that enables people to die of pneumonia without dramatic feelings of suffocating or drowning. So do we treat it? Do we treat it with antibiotics? Or do we treat it with symptom control? And the other would be pain control. People have varying thresholds of pain. There are people in this room who say, any pain, put me out. I don't care what it is. Then I have my friend who goes to the dentist. No matter what they do, she doesn't need Novocaine. So we got all kinds. And some people will say, what matters to me most is that I can interact with people. And if I'm in some pain, but I can still interact, that's great. But some others say, you know what, I can't handle it. I can't handle pain, so keep me comfortable. Whatever it takes. And we know now that whatever it takes to control some people's pain may shorten their life. You know about that? We can give people, and do give people, every day, all the time, across this country, doses of pain medication to address their pain that shorten their life by reducing their respirations, and they die. That's an important piece to think about, and we can come back to that if we need to. So when we interviewed people all over Minnesota, here were the things they answered to this question. What are the most important factors for you when you consider end-of-life decisions? In this order, this is what they said. Philosophy of life, that means things like what makes your life a quality life. My dad, when he had his heart attack, was devastated that he probably never, well, he didn't know he was going to die a month later of the second one, but that he would never play golf again. Preach golf. That's what he did with his life. Some people would say, all that matters to me is that I can interact with people around me who I love. That's what matters. Others would say, if I can't travel, whatever it might be for your life quality. Second most important factor was experience people had had already with family and friends. I never want to be like Uncle So-and-so. They kept him going forever. Or, you know, my aunt decided she didn't want anything, and they probably could have at least, you know, set her hip fracture, and she wouldn't have been in such pain as she died. But she said no. I mean, most of us have stories. We say yes, no. That helps us think about it. Thirdly, religious beliefs, and we found a fascinating piece here that I'd like to explore sometime. That is, people's religious belief influenced them both ways. And let me say what I mean by that. There are people who say, God gave us life. Life at all costs is my responsibility. And that means life in whatever way it can be sustained. On a respirator with tube feedings, perfectly fine. It's called the vitalist position in ethics. That means as long as you can keep me going, whatever man and woman have created to keep me going, do it. That's my religious perspective, some people say. It's not mine. Others say, I believe in life after this life, and so death isn't the worst thing that can happen to me. So we have people using religion to support several kinds, but notably two dramatically opposed kinds of positions. Cultural influences were important also. Some studies of Navajo people in the Southwest and notably several Asian ethnic groups, elderly Asian folks on the West Coast, find different ethnic understandings of these end-of-life discussions. And in some cultures, you do not approach the person and say, what it is that you want. This person will say, do not discuss it with me. That is bad and energy. And there's a word in the Navajo language that I keep meaning to memorize that says, it's bad for you to talk about this with me. Talk with my whole family. Others say, this is a clan decision. This is a family decision. Autonomy is not the primary value or ethic in many cultures in our country, and we're gaining increasing understanding about that. Others said, well, my ability to function independently, or whether I have to pay for a nursing home, and my kids wouldn't get the money, and how much pain I'm in, those are things to think about too. But the others were the most important. Okay, let me skip a little bit. Choosing an agent. How many of you right now in this room are single, widowed, or divorced? Yeah, fair number. Okay. If you're single, widowed, or divorced, and you're 18 or over, who do you think makes decisions in the event that you can't?
State.
Nope.
Parents.
Parents. Mm. Number one, parents. So I say this to my gay friends who aren't partnered and haven't done an advanced directive, and they say, my mom is in a nursing home. I can't imagine having her decide. Say, well, get partnered with an agent. Doesn't mean you have to be in a relationship. Get partnered with somebody who you trust and believe would help you. I tell it to my college students, and they're pretty okay with it. Well, mom and dad are still part of their everyday life. But for many adults, they have disabled parents, or parents they wouldn't want to burden, or parents who couldn't do it for some reason, or parents from whom they're estranged. So that's very important. If you're married, it's your spouse. In every state.
Another issue with that for single is if your family lives out of state.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'll get to how you choose somebody and how you decide who that is. For kids, it's obvious. It's parents, and kids can't do advanced directives. They have to be 18.
Parents are dead.
If your parents are dead, then it is your children, if you have them, and it is your children equally. You've got 15 children, they all 15 have to agree.
You
got two who don't talk to each other.
They have to be a majority of age, though.
Yes, they have to be 18 and over. Yeah, that's correct. And then it gets a little hazier. So what if I'm single, I have no kids, and my parents have died? Then, depending on the state, they list out the legal next of kin, and it's oldest sibling and down, and then it's cousins, aunts, and uncles. I mean, it goes through, and I never remember exactly. I have to check it each time in Minnesota when it's a question. So that's important to understand. So when you choose someone to be your healthcare agent or proxy, it needs to be someone you trust, someone who has similar values and beliefs about medical care and death and dying as you do. That means you have to talk about it. Say, what do you think about these things? It's somebody who will not be intimidated by other people who want to take control at the end, notably the daughter who flies in from California and says, what do you mean you're deciding this? I mean, it's classic. We talk about them all the time. I'm sorry if there are any daughters from California. But I moved back from Seattle to Minnesota, so I wouldn't be the daughter who flew in and made a big issue. So it's somebody who can't be intimidated, somebody who will really serve as an advocate for your interests. In ethics, we call this notion of a proxy substituted judgment. It's not what I think you would have wanted. It's what I know you would have wanted because I'm acting as you in this situation. Very different, very different. Somebody who will be available, that's your point. You know, if you have a family member or a dear friend who travels in Europe half the year, I wouldn't name that person. Somebody you can talk with ahead of time about these issues who is willing to listen and spend the time with you to talk about it. Somebody who can make decisions under stress. I don't mean ever to say these are light things to pick somebody to do. It's very difficult. Somebody who's able to carry out your preferences, and I love this one, and someone not too close to let you die. So that you don't have somebody who's at the last minute saying, I know she wouldn't have wanted this, but I can't bear to let her go. It's tough. It's really tough. I'm crying thinking about it. I don't even have a situation I'm thinking about at the moment. You can have a family member. You can have a friend. In rare instances, when people don't have somebody locally, they could ask the healthcare provider in some states. You've got to look at your own law. Do you name more than one? You can. If you name two, depending on your form and how it's written, you have to be clear either that they must agree. Some people say, I can't choose among my two children. So you say, put two children, they must agree. Then you tell your two children, I've put down that you two must agree, and here's what I want. So they've heard it from you. Or you say, here is my proxy, and here is my substitute proxy. If they can't find someone, they're up in the boundary waters, you have a second name. Some even allow for a third name. So you certainly can put up a backup proxy. Now, how best to communicate these decisions that you've made to your agent and your healthcare providers? When we interviewed people around the state, this was fascinating. One guy said, and these are wonderful suggestions from people who've had these decisions. One guy said, well, I think you should talk to people the sooner the better, and I think about age 60 is good. I think he's 80-something. I think 60. Well, I think 18. Myself. Another guy said, I think you should talk about it in a quiet, private place, not in the doctor's office, but go walking with your physician in the park. About a fifth of our respondents, this was very interesting, we said to him, when you're discussing this with your physician, would you want somebody present with you, and if so, who? And a fifth of them said, nobody. It's my decision and mine alone. I don't even want my proxy in here. It's very interesting. It's important, I think, in your own situation to talk to your healthcare provider when you've done an advanced directive. Give it to your doctor, and I'll talk about who should have them and where you keep them. Ask about your specific situation. Look, doc, my age, my diagnoses, what are my chances of surviving CPR? My little card has a little pie chart, which is really useful to healthcare providers. Well, statistically speaking, here's your chance. But somebody in a session this morning, I think it was your session, statistics don't help one individual person. Person says, well, I'm the one that's gonna defy all statistics. And you might be. Or I had a number of older people say to me, don't tell me the data, I don't want it to change my mind. I don't want my doctor, one woman was 70 years old and a nun, and she said she's healthy and pretty vigorous, and her doctor said, she brought in her advanced directive, she said, if I have CPR in the convent, I'm telling the nuns to not do CPR. I mean, a heart attack, telling them not to do CPR. He said, well, that's crazy. If you had a heart attack in my office, I would do it. She said, then you're not my doctor anymore. She said, I don't want it. He said, but you're 70, your chances are, you know, pretty good, 10%, 15%. She said, I don't care. It's not how I want to live. To come back to what? I'm ready. That's my time. God's ready. Very interesting. So stats can be useful. They can be helpful. And they can maybe not sway anybody one single bit. So you might ask about it in your particular case. A couple more suggestions based on our research, and then we have a little time here. Just like last night's discussion, have these conversations with your proxy and others beforehand, and ideally with your physician. Though we know that most people don't have family physicians anymore, and so do your best if you can. When something in your condition changes, you've got a new diagnosis, might change your mind, revisit what you've written. Now, when you do an advanced directive and a durable power of attorney for medical care, whether they're the same document or two different documents, what do you do with them? Safety deposit box? No. Drawer in the basement? I was preparing for this. I said, I better go find mine. It was a drawer in the basement. Now, I do have it. I brought it along. I reread it. I did it 3 years ago because I did these talks for the last 10 years, and people would say, do you have one? I'd say, no. Now I do. No, you keep them out where your proxy can find it. Now, how many copies do you have around? It's up to you, but here's the general suggestion. You make sure your physician has one at the clinic where you go. You say to the physician, will you also send us to the hospital where I will likely be cared for? Every hospital has a place on the chart where advanced directives are put, and it's usually right on top. Some of them have hot pink stickers, some of them have chart binders or dividers that say, you know, advanced directive or living well or something. So those are two. You keep the original yourself somewhere sort of easy, in the kitchen drawer right handy. Most people don't want to stick it on the refrigerator. That would be the best, but that's a little much. You make sure your proxy has one. You make sure an alternate proxy has one. And then I suggest you make sure a lawyer, if you have a lawyer, don't go out and get one just to hand a living will to. That's unnecessary. I suggest clergy, if you're close to some clergy member. Okay, and I think clergy should have a drawer in their desk or somewhere in their office that says living wills of my congregation. I suggest you hand it to every other person who thinks they should have been your proxy. And I say that with all seriousness. You've got your best friend for 45 years, and you've talked to her about this stuff, but you named your daughter. Your daughter comes flying from California, your best friend says, she didn't want this. The daughter says, my mother, I'm the proxy. You need to know that you have to talk to your best friend so she doesn't jump in. It just gets messy. So you got maybe 8-10 copies out there, right? Now my next suggestion is revisit it when you either get a new diagnosis or you change your thinking on something or you become converted to some other way of thought. Then you have to go out and say to all those people,
give it back to those people that you've designated.
That's right. If you change your proxy, you gotta get all the old copies back, give them a new one. Okay? The latest copy that anybody comes up with, dated, is the one that's gonna hold. So if you forget and somebody shows up with an old one and it's a different proxy and someone else has this one, it's gonna be the most recent. People say, you know, how often should I check it? I think every couple years is really smart. I've been 3 years and I still agree with everything I wrote, but my life hasn't changed a lot from 39 to 42. Some do it every year. I wouldn't let it go more than 3-4 years before you revisit it so you remember where it is and check out the proxy. Is he still alive? Does she still agree with you? That kind of thing. Recognize that most of the forms your state uses were written by committee. They are not ideal, just like any legislation, that you can't anticipate every possibility. And this is very important, and our research showed this is the one thing people remembered from their discussion. You can change your mind anytime. Anytime. So if you have decisional capacity and your proxy shows up and says to the doctor, well, I'm the proxy and she wanted me to not get a feeding tube, you look at your doctor and say, that's hogwash. Put in a feeding tube. If the doctor says at the time you have decisional capacity, you'll put in a feeding tube. Okay? So your verbal word as a competent person at any time will override anything you've written. Now the flip side of that is having a conversation with your spouse tonight when you go back to your chalet and you say, geez, you know, Mary talked about this, and don't ever do this to me. This is what I'd really like. And you never write it down. Yeah. And something happens and your spouse goes to the doctor and says, she wouldn't have wanted this. She told me at the chalet at Holden Village in 1999, that's not gonna hold up anymore, folks. Never really did. And the Nancy Cruzan case in Missouri proved that point. It went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. People have a right to die. They have a right to control their decisions at the end of life, but they must do it by proxy and in writing. Okay? That's very important. You know, so these little shreds of conversation, oh, she said she never wanted to be like Aunt Joanne or live that way, that's not going to do it. The other thing that I'd suggest is people not use vegetable. I don't want to live like a vegetable. I've always hated that phrase. I have my twigs, don't twitches. That's one of them. Persistent vegetative state is a medical diagnosis, which is what Karen Quinlan had and some Nancy Cruzan had and others. So don't let me live like a vegetable, and don't use vague terms like do everything possible, unless you really believe that. Because as you've all seen, everything possible can mean tubes from head to foot. And isolated in an intensive care unit, machines beeping, we can do a lot. So I'm gonna let people ask me questions while I hand. Here's what I'm going to say. The white one is the Minnesota most recent version. So if you're from Minnesota, take this and it'll be good. If you're not, take it anyway, because it covers the kind of stuff that most states would recognize, but you need to check your state. You can look at this Five Wishes. It's a very simplified document that a national organization has just done. This purple one is a worksheet. It's really nice. In this event, if this happens, these are the kinds of things I think about. This is my faith belief. This is my thought about blah, blah, blah. That's really nice. So everybody who can get their hands on one should take that. I'm not sure quite broad enough, but almost. So this might be useful. So what do people want to say or add or ask?
In the case of somebody being capable of saying, I do want that too. And then they slip back to where they can't make a decision. Have they negated the whole thing?
That's a messier situation, because then the best doctor will say to that person, I'm going to put the tube in because you want it. And here, with your situation, is what I predict about this tube, that we need it just till we get your intestinal blockage taken care of.
Yeah.
And we'll take it out. You say, fine. That's great. The doctor might also say, now, if you have to keep this in forever and always be fed through the tube, would you like it left in? In the event that person slipped away, the best doctor would do that.
If you get all the information, you can take it.
If you do, that's right. Now, does that always happen? No. Surgeon says, great, I'll stick it to a bit. Ethically speaking, not starting artificial nutrition or hydration is the same, ethically, as ending nutrition or hydration that has been begun. Ethically, they're the same.
Say that again.
Okay. Not starting a tube feeding. If somebody can't eat by mouth, like my mother, end-stage Alzheimer's, couldn't be fed. Us deciding don't put in a tube to feed her is ethically the same decision, has the same moral weight by ethical agreement across our country as starting it and then 6 weeks later taking it out. Okay? Because it's a medical treatment that we, as her surrogate decision makers, have the right to end. Do you think it's any more difficult, however, to end something that has been begun than to never start it in the first place?
Yeah.
Emotionally, stopping nutrition or hydration is far more difficult than never starting it in the first place. That's why people's ideas about, well, if it looks to be temporary, and if temporary is a year, great, do it for me for a year. After that, if it looks like it's forever and I can't make a decision, maybe I don't want it, and then take it up, you know? So I'm saying morally and ethically, those are the same decision. Personally, emotionally, very much more different. Stopping is more difficult.
Yeah. Minnesota has combined that now. Is it important to revisit what we did?
Very good question. The statute says any previous documents that were executed in Minnesota will be honored in our state. Practice says you'd be smart to revisit it anyway. Now, I frankly like the old form of the living will better, though I didn't like that it only went into play when someone was terminally ill with 6 months or less to live. That didn't cover a whole lot of situations. I like the form better, so that's too bad, because the new form doesn't allow much space to write, but this much for each of these issues. But you're perfectly fine if you've done one earlier that has the same basic stuff in it which the earlier forms did. And the previous agent form is the same. People say, do I need a lawyer to do an advance directive? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Could a lawyer help you do one? It depends on the lawyer. Again, a lawyer, they're not the same. A tax lawyer has no business doing this stuff. A lawyer who does a lot of this has every bit of business. If that's the person you want to talk with, by all means. Now, who else can do it with you? Can every doctor do these discussions well? I don't think so. I have orthopedic surgeon friends who would no more want to have this discussion than fly. That's why they're orthopedic surgeons. Anesthesiologists don't want to do this. We just had this issue at our hospital. I won't go into it. Family practice docs? Yeah, they're pretty good at this stuff. Internists, they're pretty good. Nurse practitioners? Great. Nurses? Could be great. Social workers? Every social worker? No. some social workers at county social services wouldn't know squat about this. A medical social worker?
Yeah.
Any old minister? I don't think so. Most ministers aren't prepared in this stuff. So find a professional you trust. Do you need a professional? No. You can do it all by yourself in the privacy of your own home. You can name a proxy and hand it to him, say, here, don't ask me any questions, it's you. And go away. And it would be legal. Can that person say no? Yeah, it's hard. But that person, I suppose, could just get scarce when the time came. And if there's nobody else listed, then the person's in trouble. So that's kind of not a good idea. Yeah.
What about your Lutheran Brotherhood agent?
The ones I know, I wouldn't go to. Because this is more complicated than that. But you know what? If it's somebody you've had a 25-year relationship with who knows all these terms, you know, it really needs to be somebody who can talk about what CPR involves. It needs to be somebody with some medical knowledge, for sure.
This is a testimony, I guess, but my father died in April, and two brothers and I had to make the decision to remove feeding a week before he died, and he had done everything right. And it was so easy.
It really helped. Yeah,
there wasn't anybody that questioned me.
And by doing everything, did he write, Dan, or did he just talk with you all?
No, it was all written.
All written, so yeah. That really helped.
Well written.
Yeah. Because some people do say, I've talked to my kids, they all know what I want, they all agree to abide by my wishes, they don't write anything down, the time gets to the deathbed. And one kid says, I'm not done. I'm not done with Mom. I can't let her go. We were separate for so long. I'm not ready. That's when it gets messy, if it isn't written.
Yeah, I can
attest to that.
That too, because a year ago, my parents are both up in their 80s, and they've always talked, they didn't want all this stuff. And my wife is a nurse, and so we were out in New Jersey a year ago, and we said, okay, let's write this down and get this done. And so we did a death directive. My mother died last month. And the hospital wanted to start feeding to, and my brother said that's not her wishes, and he had to. My other brother was involved, was not sure, and we gave him the form and said, oh, that's what she wanted. This is great.
In her handwriting.
Yeah, and so it worked out just cool.
Yeah.
For us, good. And she was ready to go. She decided, you know, that was it.
Yeah. Well, bless her for giving it to you. You know, this is not a slam against hospitals. I've worked in them my whole life. I love them. But physicians and nurses are trained, prepared, ethically committed to saving life. And the machinery goes. Somebody described it not long ago as just kind of a bulldozer. And there are a lot of people involved. And if it's an urban teaching hospital, you got residents coming in. It's really hard for families to say, whoa, or a proxy. That's why you have to have someone strong. Whoa, stop the machinery. Stop the decision, stop the 7 a.m. expert coming in saying, start this, start this, start this. This is what my mother wanted, and this is what she didn't want. You know, you gotta hold it up in their faces sometimes. And if there are people at the hospital not paying attention, then you go to the patient representative, the social worker, your own doctor, in case it's not the one on that day, because it often is, and you scream. You walk into the administrator's office if you have to, and you scream and you say, this is legal, this is law, and you've got to pay attention. There have been cases where people have been taken to court for battery, for doing treatment that went against an advance directive. Mm-hmm. Battery, very rare, two cases, I think, and I'm not sure if they got thrown out or something, but, you know?
I'm not familiar with the advance directive situation with hospice, but we work with hospice. And one of the things that we began to recognize right away with our hospice training is exactly what you said. The health professionals, the nurses and the doctors, are trained to save lives. Mm-hmm. When a person is designated as a hospice patient, a physician, if the physician is savvy, says this patient has no more than 6 months to live. At that time, hospice says, let the person die comfortably the way that person wants to. And there are still physicians, and I can remember a real turmoil when I first got in hospital. It wasn't my personal case, but one of the head nurses took issue with the hospice nurses and said, you don't know what you're doing. On the contrary, it was the other way around. this head nurse needed to understand what hospice was all about. The best book on the subject is Ira Byock, Dying Well.
Dying Well.
Because he takes physicians apart. He's a physician himself in Missoula, in one of the foremost hospice programs in the country. And he takes physicians apart on that issue.
And the hospices I'm familiar with require, in almost every case, that people are no CPR. That is, do not resuscitate. Mm-hmm. They agree to that one piece of the whole advanced directive. And it is practice in our hospice locally that the admitting nurse and social worker do the opening visit, and they offer to work through an advanced directive with the person right there. Not just the no CPR piece, but all the rest of this. But in most hospices I'm aware of, it's not only the, quote, 6 months left to live, but no CPR. It doesn't mean no treatment always, because there are palliative treatments for pain control. But yeah, that's helpful. A couple more minutes we have. Yeah.
There may be some other options to consider in this. And I don't know whether you touched on it, because I came in late. But things like do not transfer orders for somebody who's in a nursing home setting, may be very appropriate. Mm-hmm. Withholding antibiotic treatment for somebody who has recurrent pneumonia,
mm-hmm,
perfectly legitimate. And we don't necessarily know about those things unless we've worked in a medical setting. But those are things that you can spell out, and you might want to spell out in an advanced directive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In our local nursing homes, they call it the limited treatment plan. And at admission, they say things like, if these things happen, do you want to go to the hospital or not? Do you want antibiotics? Do you want this and that? And that's very, very useful. It's different from the advanced directive, but it's another tool. It's another tool to use. Also in Minnesota, I haven't mentioned organ donation. And we're doing a couple of cases next week related to this. But in Minnesota, the healthcare directive, specifies right in there, I do or do not want my organs donated at the time of my death if they are usable, and then you can list which organs, yes or no. Not every state is going to have that on there. It holds equal weight as the donor card that people might have, or in Minnesota it's on our license, our driver's license. But our advanced healthcare directive also says, these are my funeral wishes, cremation. It also says, here's where I'd prefer to be cared for at the end of my life. For me, that's important. I'm not sure I'd want to die in my own home with little children. I might. And that's one thing I'm trying to think about a little bit. But, yes, if I am dying, take me home. Don't have me die in a facility. Do everything you can to take me home. That would be my preference. That stuff is in ours. It's a very comprehensive document. Others just cover the basics. That I've mentioned earlier. So
Mary, if you do have like a proxy, you're saying if the state has not got something like Minnesota, that your mother or father could write something like this, or can you get a document in any state like this?
Every state has something.
Okay.
Every state has some sort of quote.
But it's more specifics, what I'm saying. I'm hearing you say rather.
Some states are very specific, some are more general. And in every state, the durable power of attorney for health care, or the medical power of attorney, whatever it's called in your state, is legal. So minimally, if somebody named a proxy, it's all they needed to do. I can't speak for every state. If you name a proxy and then you scribble out two paragraphs that bear no resemblance to any form.
But in other words, if you have a proxy, mm-hmm, it might be nice to have this directive so that everything is very explicit.
Yes, yes. And that would help the proxy.
Yes, yes.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
The best is both.
Okay.
The best by far is both. And if in your state what the proxy has doesn't look like the statute form,
no, I think it's just
then it could be an issue. But mainly it just helps that person.
Yes.
That's right. And that person who is the proxy doesn't even have to show a document except the proxy document. You do have to bring that in to prove that you're the proxy. But yes, to guide decision making, and this purple form is really a useful worksheet for that. Give them the worksheet.
Mm-hmm.
Put this in the file that says Mary Carlson right on your desk.
Some states, too, seem to have difference in terms of how they respond to documents that deal with tube feedings or artificial nutrition, hydration, that kind of stuff. Some of them respond to that and respect it, others do not.
The Right to Life lobby in Minnesota is extremely strong. And when our first living will legislation came in about 1992, I think in response to federal law, the lobby was so strong that the compromise bill ended up saying not only was the living will only good if you were in terminal condition 6 months or less to live, but you had to, on the form, specifically address nutrition and hydration. You could say, I don't want it. But if you didn't address it, you got it. Well, you know, some states are going to be like that. This new one doesn't explicitly say you have to address it, because now this national general agreement that artificial nutrition and hydration is a medical treatment that can be withdrawn or not done. That doesn't mean that individual physicians or healthcare facilities, notably some religious ones, might not cause a ruckus. Yeah. That's the most difficult of all these. Yeah.
Mary, one of the things I also think is important is in the next step, as far as a funeral, when you've got so many kids in the family, to take that time to pick your own passages you'd like read and your own hymns, so they're not saying, well, I'd rather think she'd rather have this and that. Just write it down somewhere, give it to the pastor so he has it. And that, I mean, you can go through the LVW and pick out what rubric you want, and it's really helpful.
It's all a gift you can give them. Mm. It's all a gift. It helps when one can say, this was mom's wish. Wow, that's pretty hard to go against mom's wish when she's right in front of you alive and unable to decide, or when she's right in front of you having died and you need to decide. Yeah, that's good. We need to end it here. So I want to say, any professionals, come up and take a look at my little pocket guide to having these discussions. The five wishes information I have here. Rest of the Mo Udall story. Am I missing anything else? I don't think so. Thank you for your attention.